This is the Preach Jacobs Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, this is another episode of the Preach Jacobs Podcast. I'm your host, Preach Jacobs. Thank you guys for listening. Once again, thank you guys for supporting us at our gallery at the Coker Center for the Arts. Our next Soul House Sessions is going to be October the 22nd. It's going to be a ColaCon reunion. We're going to have hip-hop artist Jay Live on a panel. We're going to have Dre Lopez. We're going to have Ebony Toussaint of Aurora Comics Podcast. And we're also going to have Stephen Prowse, comic book writer as well, all involved with the opening of a show that we're going to have, a ColaCon anniversary show with artwork from the amazing Dan Lish from London, and amazing, amazing pieces. Also on top of that, we got some Sanford Green stuff and a surprise that we're going to announce at that show. So please make sure y'all get y'all's tickets. Go to CokerCenterForTheArts.com or go to all my socials, Preach Jacobs, to get all that stuff squared away. Thank you guys so much. Also, we also sponsored by Big Media. Thank you guys for putting this out. We also sponsored by Coker Center for the Arts and Soul House and our favorite sponsor, Tusset. Tusset, ooh. Anyways. I'm excited because the great thing about having this type of a podcast is to be able to talk to folks that I haven't seen in a while, so I have an excuse to catch up with folks, and also people that are near and dear to me, and I hope the people hearing about him for the first time make people want to get involved and check out more of his work. We have my guest, hip-hop legend. Ooh. From producer. Ooh. Legend. Ooh. From Columbia, South Carolina, via Hopkins, Midi Mark. What's going on, man?
Man, I'm chilling. You coming in hot.
Ooh. I appreciate it, man. Thank you for stopping by, man. So for the people that are unaware, Midi, it's been about 20 years that I've known that you've been making beats. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
Okay. So about two decades of really, really great hip-hop production, some of your favorite local music. He was the beat maker behind this, the producer behind this. I want to get into that in a bit. But I also think that we can start this off with something that you said that I think would be really, really interesting. Shout out to our video aide right now, Taki, who's going to have a podcast coming soon. You were talking about being Southern, not country. To folks that don't understand the distinction, what does that mean to you when someone says you country or somebody says you Southern? What does that mean?
Well, okay, so born and raised in the South, but the South isn't all country. You know, mm-hmm. country is a whole different experience, you know, usually involving, you know, living a little bit closer to the land, on the land, mm-hmm. off the land, you know, the hunting, the fishing, or, you know, just raising animals. You know, that's a little bit more of what I would consider, you know, like closer to country. Mm-hmm. The area of Hopkins that I grew up in, when we first moved there, it was definitely, you know, look way more rural than it is now, you know, a lot of new neighborhoods and everything. But the original part of Hopkins, you know, basically to the right of Garner's Ferry, you know, people had more land. There were more, yeah, farmland, mm-hmm. Well water, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, you know, is, you know, so even though, you know, born and raised in the South and, like I mentioned earlier, a little bit more country adjacent.
Yeah, diet country.
Diet country, there you go. You know,
country zero, yeah.
You know, so I used to, you know, like be with my cousins in like Goldsboro, North Carolina, or even my family in Sardis, Mississippi, Aberdeen, Mississippi, and like, especially like Sardis, Mississippi, that's actual, you know, family farmland or whatever. Like, that's country. I'm visiting, I'm doing foolish stuff like, you know, mm-hmm. showing up to a farm wearing new sneakers, and that's my only pair of shoes, you know what I mean? So by the time I'm coming back to South Carolina, like, they're just ruined, muddy, dusty.
Absolutely.
And everything. Country folks know better. Mm-hmm. That was all I needed to know. Was like, okay, yeah, this ain't quite the same.
Well, you know what? I think this is an interesting conversation, right? And I'm interested to see what you think about this. It's pretty much a 30-year anniversary. If you think about how crazy this is, it's a 30-year anniversary of when Outkast is at the Source Awards. Mm. They won, I think, Best Hip Hop Group. They got on stage and were getting booed.
Yeah.
Could you imagine Outkast, Andre 3000, one of the greatest MCs of all time, getting booed? And that's when the impassioned speech that Andre was like, yo, man, the South got something to say. I got that demo tape. Nobody want to hear it. The South got something to say. something that simple feels so revolutionary. And I think that I grew up in a situation where I had low, location self-esteem, right? Mm. Where when I was a kid, everybody pretended like they was from New York. Right,
I remember that.
You know, because the music that we grew up on, the Wu-Tangs of the world, you know, the Tribes and all this type of stuff, there wasn't this respect, even in the South, some degree of people respecting Southern hip hop or Southern hip hop being taken seriously. And mm-hmm. and as I got older, you start to learn like the beauty of the 8-Ball, the MJGs, the Scarfaces, the Outkast, the Goody Mobs, and things like that. When I hear those conversations of people talking about, oh, you know, then the South took over in the early 2000s, I'm like, no, that didn't happen. The South has been making hip hop music, been having like amazing producers and musicianship and things like that.
Right, right.
Do you still feel that even in this day and time, even with the respects of people that are from the South doing hip hop, do you still feel, and I'm not sure if you saw what's that list from that, the Pitchfork list, do you still feel that as a whole, there's not a respect for Southern hip hop the way it should be?
I definitely agree with that, that there's a respect that isn't there. But it's so strong in its influence and just existence mm-hmm. that the respect almost doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like when Enter the 36 Chambers came out,
mm-hmm.
and I'm listening to all these beats produced by the RZA.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I get older and I find out that the majority of the music that he's sampling is from Stax Records out of Memphis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these are Memphis people. These are Southern, mm-hmm. these are Southerners, you know, making this music that's being sampled, you know, or even from like the James Brown, Isaac Hayes, you know. So it's like the lack of respect is kind of tied into just ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if James Brown is this influential to this entire art form, if, you know, name it, you know, go down the list of people, you know, who mm-hmm. have been like just so sampled and just so instrumental in just the development of the sound of hip hop globally, then it's the South.
Absolutely. Have you seen that Stax documentary yet?
Actually watched it the other day. It's one of my favorite. Yeah. Yeah.
Over and over again. So sometimes when it's hard for me to go to sleep, I'll put something on and I would just like pick an episode and go through it. And it was interesting that I could see these parallels with hip hop in a certain way, right? Where there was a conversation about how Stax got fleeced by Atlantic Records and, mm-hmm. and snatched the whole catalog. And then Isaac Hayes comes out of that. But there was also this conversation that they touched on slightly, but I think it's interesting, where they were like, yo, man, we're the Southern label out of Memphis with this sound. And then you have another black label like Motown
mm-hmm.
that was kind of considered the it black music, right? It was right. It was this thing where, you know, they kind of talked about how, you know, let's be honest, man, you look at some of that early Motown stuff, everybody had processed hair, everybody was wearing some suits, and it was a way of, hey, man, we want to be presentable. That crossover word
right.
to white America. And Stax, in a way, was revolutionary in that sense, where they were just like, look, we're making a sound for people that really, really rock with this, that really get it. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think that those conversations are always happening. It's like, yo, man, the soul of all the music that you're looking for is from the South. So I would ask, because I remember the first tape I ever got as a kid. And not tapes that people like gave you copies and stuff of.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the first thing with your money that you remember hip hop wise? You don't even have to be hip hop. You can tell me the first tape you got, first CD you got that you can remember, and then first hip hop joint, if it wasn't a hip hop joint. Some old man stuff. Like we gotta think back.
So I think the first hip hop that I purchased with my own money
mm-hmm.
was actually a cassette, and it was a bootleg cassette uh-huh. of Dr. Dre's The Chronic.
Okay.
And I had to sneak and get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was at one of those, you know, it might have been it might have been Harambe, it might have been Jubilee Festival or something like that. There's always, you know, a man selling the chew sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Why was I on them chewing up things like I was 12 years old trying to be cool, man?
Yo, I had to get me a chew stick. And I had to, like, sneak around, like, look left and right, because I'm not supposed to have this music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were only $5. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was young. I was broke.
Mm-hmm.
I had $5, though.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I had money for my chew stick. And then, you know, look left, look right, make sure my mom was distracted, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And I went and bought that that chronic bootleg.
Oh, my gosh. I love it. So I bought, this wasn't the first album that I got, but my Ready to Die copy, I paid $4 for it. It was on CD, and it didn't have a cover on it. So it was just a CD. And this guy was like at the flea market, right? And so same thing, I think similar with you. Somehow, we would go to record stores, and somebody said to my dad, a parental advisory sticker. He was like, well, I ain't buying that if the sticker's on it, right?
Lord have mercy.
And funny enough, I don't know if this is true or not, that shit might have been Joey Joe. That's how old he is. I think I was like 6 years old, and Joey Joe told my daddy about the sticker, right? But so the first tape that I remember that my dad got us, my brother and I, this is like 1990-91, that we went into Sounds Familiar record store, and he had this no sticker thing. My brother got Home Base by DJ Jazzy Jeff Fresh Prince that had Summertime on it.
Wow.
And I got, because there was no sticker on it, and I remember hearing their names, I got Gangstar Step in the Arena. That was the first tape that my dad went and got us in the store. And then I had like a cousin that would just send us stuff of stuff from radio stations when he would be in New York and stuff like that. But I remember that Gangstar is like the first tape. And shout out to the people that if you had to have a sticker on it, they made the sticker really small. The people that Absolutely. Made the sticker like, bam, those are the people that were really, really hating on the younger people listening to their music.
I got to give a shout out to the Columbia Record, the CD Clubs or whatever, because their parental advisory, like they were, they were stickers.
Mm-hmm. That you could snatch off,
yeah. You know, so if you intercepted the mail, if you were able to like, hey, can I get this one, you know? And which is how I got Ready to Die.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
And I intercepted the mail and had to ask permission. I was like, Mom, can I open this? Probably my CD. And she said, yeah, her CD was in there also. She probably had some Boz Scaggs.
Hey, low key, that's jamming.
Hey, I'm not hating. I love, you know, I'm a fan of Boz because, you know, because of her. But you know, I got my CD, made sure to peel that sticker off or whatever. She's going to want to look at it, whatever, you know. Oh, and the baby on the cover, that had to, you know, add it to, you know, the parental comfort. Like, it can't be that bad.
There's
a baby on the cover. He listening to wholesome, rippity rap music with a baby on the cover. My son's so wholesome and sweet. And you know, Suicidal Thoughts,
Listen.
One More Chance, the album version.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah.
I got a question for you because I just wrote about this because September it was Suicide Prevention Month and I wrote something about suicide prevention about my family because I had like an old country uncle, great uncle that nobody ever talked about, and I found out like recently he died by suicide. Not to get heavy with that, but I turned it over talking about depression and suicide related stuff in hip hop, and one of the things I thought was always weird to me. There'd be clubs that would have March 9th parties where you would go listen to Biggie's music. And I'm like, yo, why are we celebrating when Biggie died? And then I was just like, do I know Biggie's birthday?
I don't.
Right? I think it's May 21st, right? But it was such a thing where I thought about it. And I'm like, yo, man, this dude was 23 years old. The album's called Ready to Die. The last song was called Suicidal Thoughts. And we were dancing to it. It was like, what's the Crystal Waters song? Da da dee da da.
Oh,
the whole
man.
Song. She was like, she's homeless. She's, and we like dancing to this homeless.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she could find her, right? Like, but I always thought about it. Where it was just like, maybe that was the only way that he's like, I can talk about this, right? You know. And so it's really interesting, right? Where I think about the amount of hip hop I was listening to at such a young age. Here's what I think you would get a kick out of. So my mom had an agreement with me and my brother. She was like, look, I'll get y'all tapes with stickers on them. Just do good in school, and I don't want y'all hearing. I don't want y'all saying this stuff. So there was one Christmas. My brother got a tape, and I got a tape. And one day, I let the boombox playing too long when I went outside. My mama heard the tape.
Oh,
do you know the nastiest tape that my mama got that she was just like, what is this? The nastiest tape. I don't think you would guess who it was. Like, throws it away. I got MC Lyte's Act Like You Know. And the tape had two sides, a tough side and a rough side. When I tell you that B side, because my mom was like, oh, MC Lyte, she's cute. Derek got a crush on her.
Okay. Right.
Yo, she was cussing up a storm. My mom was like, is that the tape that I bought you? Right? Dog, you have no idea. She, like, if you find that album again, find it on the DSPs. And she was going in. MC Lyte was going in on a joint. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I got caught with Lil' Kim's Hardcore.
Listen, man, we all did.
I wish my mom was here so she can give, like, her, you know, part two, her point of view of the story or whatever. But, like, it was one of the most awkward moments of my life. And, like, she got a, for those who don't know, my mom has very Claire Huxtable qualities, just, you know, in the sense of, like, being able to, like, control the mood of the room with a finger wave, a glance, you know, just her body language or whatever. And, like, yeah, she saw that cover. Oh, boy. And then also me trying to be sneaky, you know, because this was the same day that, you know, I was like, oh, mom, can we stop at Circuit City? Because I want to get the new Wyclef album. So that was, Wyclef was the
clean one. Yeah.
But then, you know, I also slid in that, you know, let me get this Lil' Kim also whatever. But yeah, she saw that cover. And then she just, like, I don't even remember her mouth moving, but I heard words coming out. She was, and she just, like, gave me detailed instructions on, like, step by step, like, what to do. Like, hand me the CD. And she opened it up. She looked at it. Like, there's just nothing good for a mother to see in front of her son or whatever. Like, then things got interesting. She was like, put it in the CD player.
Oh, Lord.
The good stereo in the living room.
And if I'm not mistaken, that opening introduction.
So I knew enough to just go to track two. But track two wasn't too much better because, you know, like, the I used to be scared of the, now I throw, you know what I mean? So, yeah. So I got sent to my room, and then she got on the phone and called my dad, and I just, you know, heard her out there, whatever. It's like, Corey, she called my dad Corey. Corey, this boy done bought this Lil' Kim CD up in here, and she make Minnie Riperton look like Mother Teresa. Confiscated. And my dad is funny. Like, when I turned 18, I'm like 14, 13, maybe 14 when this all happens or whatever. So when I turned 18, like, I come home from school, like, there's a box on my bed, and it's like all of the things that have been confiscated from over the years. He had just kept all of them. That Lil' Kim CD was in there also, along with the Master P, the I'm About It, the movie on VHS.
Man. Oh my gosh. Listen, you know what? I would rather have the music confiscated than what other parents used to do, which was buy the Walmart version. Like, a Nicholas rendition of Doggy Style. Yo. It's like I would rather just not hear it at all if you're going to take it all away.
I had friends on my street, you know, brothers, they would come down and their parents would buy them anything as long as it was the Walmart version. And, like, they'd be so excited. They'd be like, oh, we got to do it. They came down the street with it. We got ready to die. We got Life After Death.
It's just an instrumental.
And, you know, I'll be in a good sport with listening to it and everything. And then, you know, Walmart had absolutely no shame, or they did no detailing with the edits. It was just, they were just going to reverse it. And it was like, what's what?
The Exorcist. Now, here's the thing, though. After all of this, right, we turned out fine, right? Like
did we?
Like, I mean, I don't know. That's me and my therapist. But I say that, but I say that in the sense of, you know, it's every child's job. Because, mm-hmm. like, if you're young and you want to rebel, you get in your 20s, you rebel against the system, you rebel against the government, you whatever. When you're a kid, you rebel against your parents, right?
Right.
So very rarely, you know, which the exception that I see sometimes when I was working at a record store, very rarely did you see, like, when older white folks come in with their kids and their kids are buying the stuff that their parents listen to. Mm-hmm. So like, oh, when I first listened to the White Album by the Beatles, right? That's a very rare thing. But traditionally, kids are supposed to not, you know, listen to the music that their parents didn't listen to or their parents don't like. So I think it was natural, right? So if I guess the way I'm saying it is, if you have a generation of people acting up, I don't think it was the music. What do you think it was? Or do you think it was the music?
I think, you know, just the nature of being a kid and adolescent or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after a while, you get tired of hearing your parents saying or alluding to them knowing what's best. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so part of that rebellion is, you know, a little bit of it, I think, is, you know, outside of, you know, basic curiosity, because mm-hmm. even if your parents say, OK, this is going to happen if you do this or whatever, you want to see if they're right or see if they're wrong, mm-hmm. you know. And I think as soon as, you know, music became popular, or just, I guess, the advancement of pop music, I think every generation had what they were listening to while they were going against the grain, you know, with their parents. So I don't think it was like music is just one form of media. Like we were consuming all sorts of, you know, media, you know, even the video games, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that was something that was, you know, talked about a lot.
Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat, the most dangerous, you know, game ever. Now it just looks, I don't know. Well, I guess now, Was there a surprise with your family, your parents, that when you started to get into beat making?
No, I don't think there was it wasn't a surprise. And before they knew what I was actually doing, mm-hmm. you know, just from across the room, it just looks like, oh, he's just listening to music, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Both of my parents were, you know, audiophiles, you know, they had their collections there. And it just, you know, both sides of the family, you know, different types of, you know, being into music or whatever, you know, there's people, there's singers, you know, there's musicians on both sides of the family, mm-hmm. you know, so that wasn't a surprise. I think the surprise was when they started hearing from like people in the community, you mm-hmm. know, saying, hey, I saw your son was doing this, mm-hmm. you know, he was in the newspaper or mm-hmm. whatever. I think that was the surprise that, because, you know, they don't really know hip hop like that, mm-hmm. you know, so if I'm, you know, playing something for them, it's, oh, you know, that's good, Mark. But they don't know if it's actually good. Like, where does it stand, you know, when it leaves this house or whatever, you know.
Context. Well, when was the moment that you felt, because I guess this always comes from the artist conversation that I have, and especially, I think we had similar backgrounds, that both of my parents came from Eastover, both of my parents picked cotton, you know. Both
Your parents from Eastover?
Yeah.
I did not. I was today years old.
Yeah, parents from Eastover, man. Listen, you get a kick out of this.
It makes sense. The last name Jacobs. Yeah.
Listen, man. What's my guy's name from out there? Oh my gosh, with Streetside. What's my man from out there? Oh my gosh,
Misfit.
Yes, I'm at a funeral for my great aunt.
Oh yeah.
I see Misfit. I dap him up. He said, "Man, what's going on?" I said, "What's going on?" He looked at me. He said, "What you doing here?" I said, "Nigga, what you doing here?" We start. Right? And somehow, some way, I think we're cousins somehow. I think my great aunt that passed away, I think he said that her first husband was his uncle or something like that.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
But that's what ends up happening, right? Is that I had this joke that I said that you talk about country. Country is this. I don't know the names of my relatives until I see the funeral program, right? Because we call an aunt Buddy, and I look at, right?
I got you.
Yeah, Aunt Skeeter.
I got right? you.
Listen, I'm like, Uncle Butch, and I'm like, I see the funeral program, I'm like, who is this, right? So that's something real country. Listen, my mama's, my granny's sisters, we had Buddy, we had Skeeter, Tootie. I still don't know Tootie real name, right? But that's what we call them.
Right, you
know
right, I mean? Right, 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 right.
But I digress. But I say that in a sense of come from the background of telling my parents and my family that I'm doing something creatively.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that they weren't supportive. It was because they didn't see anybody making a living doing that.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, 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 yeah.
But there might have been a moment in time where they looked at what you were doing and sort of like you're saying, maybe it was a newspaper article, maybe it was somebody from the community. There was probably this shift where maybe they might not have been convinced that you could make a living out of it, but that pressure was taken off. And it was like, I support you. Do you remember a moment like that happening where something happened community-wise, communication-wise, where they were like, oh, okay, this boy, I trust what you're trying to do right now?
Well, so I don't feel like, I feel like there were times where my parents didn't understand what I was doing. But I never felt like they didn't support what I was doing, mainly because, you know, I was thinking about it the other day. It's like, because I have friends who, you know, I have peers who were, you know, when we were in middle school, high school or whatever, you know, their parents so disapproved of them working on music, making music, that they would like confiscate equipment, you know.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Or just, you know, say, you know, you're not going to be using up my electricity doing this or whatever, you know. My parents never, my dad was probably the last to kind of like understand what I was doing, but even he never got in my way of, and he allowed me to be in the house and he kept lights on, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff or whatever. And because, you know, if it wasn't anything else, it was constructive. And I was at home working on it, you know.
And you went out in the streets.
I wasn't out in the streets, you know.
Gallivanting.
And, you know, once I graduated high school and was kind of like moving around the city a little bit more and, you know, networking and meeting new people, you know, they might have like worried about who I was around and, you know. But, no, my parents have always been supportive. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I have a final question. I think you will understand and be interested in this. So I'm born and bred in Colombia, and at some point we all hit this crossroad when everyone's saying if you're doing creative stuff, especially if you're doing hip hop music, black culture, black art, there's always this argument of you got to get the hell out of here. You got to go somewhere else to do this. You got to go somewhere else to do that. And I've heard those things for years. And sometimes I felt like, man, maybe I could have gone, I should have gone. Then there's other times where I'm like, you know, my family's here. I have a special needs sibling that really kind of made me want to be here. Or maybe that was an excuse I gave myself. I don't know. But I'm an ambassador to the city. And when I've grown older over the times, I realized that if everyone is saying get out of here, to make a decision to stay is a revolutionary act. Right.
Yeah.
If you make a decision to be like, yo, I'm going to be here, not because things are as good as it is in a different city, but because they're not as good as they are in another city. And there's this responsibility that I have where I want to be able to try to make some type of a difference. What do you feel by being here as an artist here, where your talents, I will put your production skills, I will put your work ethic, I will put you as a human being up against anybody from these other areas that might have more people coming out of them. What is it about here that, if you're looking at other people talking about leaving, what does Columbia or South Carolina offer that these other neighbor places don't offer that you are happy that you stuck around?
And that's a great question. And just to kind of like go back to, you mentioned, you know, the time where people have very like low self-esteem as far as their location. And that was just never me.
Right.
You know, and there was lots of uncertainty about, okay, like, well, what's going to happen or whatever. But just in my like traveling to other places, mm-hmm. The only thing that I would, that I kind of like, not really envied or whatever. Well, maybe it was envy or whatever. You know, you go to a big city and there's like these, you know, super cool concerts and music festivals mm-hmm, happening or whatever, which is starting to become a thing that, well, mm-hmm. which has become a thing in Colombia. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. it's like the want for that isn't quite the same like it was back in the day.
Yeah.
Because you can see these folks here. I got to see Ghostface and Sheik Looch.
Sure, yeah.
And Rhapsody. And Talib Kweli,
yeah,
at Colacon, mm-hmm. I got, you know, this man, and then all of the people that I got to see through Love, Peace, and Hip Hop,
mm-hmm.
like, and that's here. Like, I got to see Rakim mm-hmm. in Colombia at the Senate, and he wasn't that far away from me, you know. Word what I mean?
Up. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or just, but then even just from the people being here, like KRS-One was here. He's been here several times throughout mm-hmm. the, you know, past, you know, couple decades. But the studio that I work for, that I work at now, at the mm-hmm. Jam Room, like he stayed in town and ended up recording with Master Splinter.
Word him up.
And so I just show up because at that time I live like pretty close to the Jam Room. So I show up, you know, on the way home from work and he's there recording. I get to meet him. You know what I mean? Like yeah. I didn't have to go out of town mm-hmm. for those experiences. But then also, you know, as far as like the networking with other independent artists, you know, I go to other cities, you know, me and DJ Cannon Banyan and DJ Effect. And
yeah,
DJ
buddy. Dice.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah, buddy.
You know, the places that I've gone with them, you know, me and Cannon Banyan drove to a DJ conference in New York,
mm-hmm.
and it was in Manhattan. I forgot the name of the thing, or whatever. But like, we were looking at their style of networking at mm-hmm. this conference and everything, and it was just, it's like we were the only ones that showed up to work.
Mm-hmm.
I had my laptop, like there was so much not networking happening mm-hmm. and people just like really just partying really
yeah.
that I had my laptop with me. So I just started making beats like right there in the, mm-hmm. in the club. Cannon Banyan, I'm remixing songs, whatever. Cannon Banyan got his laptop. I'm sending him the remixes. He's making the mixtape of the remixes yeah. like right there. Like, and same thing with you know, all these other cities, they got their own struggles or whatever, mm-hmm. but like, in their own style of doing things, but me traveling to these other places, you know.
They ain't got nothing on y'all's work ethic.
I mean, I just didn't feel like I was missing anything by living.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Here, you know, I've always loved living here.
Yeah.
You know.
I tell people this when they say, what do you love most about your family? I say, they're mine. Right. That's how I feel about my city. And I think that it's yeah. important to have people that make a decision to stay here. Right. Because the world is smaller. Like you ain't got to move to these places and do the music and do the arts and the culture. You know what I mean? We can travel. But to want to be here and have roots here is really, really important. Anything left you want people to know about how they can find you? You say you're over at the Jam Room. Like, you know, if anything that you're pushing, promoting, like, let's flood the people now. What you got?
Oh, man. I'm working with a new artist named Kilo Hotel. Mm-hmm. You can find both of us on Instagram,
and we'll put it in the podcast notes as well.
Okay, but yeah, Kilo Hotel, Flirting with Disaster. It's a EP that I produced. Kind of different from what a lot of folks have heard from me. Most folks, you know, are familiar to the hip hop I produced. This mm-hmm. was a whole different situation. This is a little bit of country, a little bit of rock and roll.
Word them up.
Definitely has, you know, some hip hop elements in there mm-hmm. because it's me, you know. But yeah, Kilo Hotel, Flirting with Disaster, and man, I don't know what the future holds. I got plans, but you know, just stay tuned. You know, I'm gonna surprise myself. I'm gonna surprise y'all also. You know.
Word. Well, listen, man. I'm glad you sat down, and if no one told you lately, like, we really appreciate the work that you've done here. And a lot of times when we're doing the work and we're in the middle of it, we don't think what we're doing makes a difference. But like I said, after just saying it in perspective 20 years, like that's 20 years of people looking up observing and learning from the work that you're doing. So I'm so glad that you came, man. I appreciate you sitting down with me. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, this is the Preach Jacobs Podcast. Get your tickets for the next Soul House sessions at the Coker Center for the Arts. Go to CokerCenterForTheArts.com or go to all of my socials, all Preach Jacobs. Buy those tickets. The next edition of the Soul House sessions is October 22nd. The Colacon reunion is going to be fantastic, and we have an announcement to make that day. So please get your tickets. I know the show will sell out. Until next time, peace.
The preceding podcast is solely owned by its host or hosts and is distributed by Big Media LLC. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved.